Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 22, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. Some California schools are now serving 100% organic and GMO-free lunch. Plus, a new study examines if we retain information better when we read it in print or digital formats. And we'll tell you which NFL player says he's going to donate all of this year's salary to educational charities. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we're talking to an expert on open educational resources like open textbooks. Our guest will explain how your state could save millions of dollars and have a better resource for students. Hey everybody, Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined with student data ninja Tyler Cummings of School Status and teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Tyler, how you doing over there?
Really good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, glad to have you back. I know you guys are always hitting it hard, but whenever Thanksgiving break comes up, you slow down like schools do, right, with School Status?
Yes, often. I've got some training scheduled into December and January already, but it's starting to kind of even out. I wouldn't say slow down, just even
but
out.
They're going
to
give you a break though, right? Like you get a break for Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah. So somewhere in there. I mean, you know, we have all got to eat turkey.
Yeah, that's right. You got any big plans? You going anywhere? You probably drive all the time. So you're like, I'm just going to have a staycation, huh?
Something like that. Yeah. We always do a big Thanksgiving at our house. So, I'll fry a couple turkeys and we've got our neighbors are going to come over and my, mother-in-law and my sister's, family is going to come up, and so we've got all kinds of folks coming in, and we're going to have a good time.
Lissa raised her eyebrows when you said mother-in-law. I don't know. We're not going to go there, though. Lissa, just save us.
Let's I don't my... know your mother-in-law.
Well, I can tell you this. My mother-in-law is a saint. I love her to death, and I could not raise my family without her help.
Oh, so. Wow.
I hope that's great.
I hope she listens to the podcast.
Sure that, I'll make sure that she does listen to this episode, but she is a fantastic woman, and I really respect her and love her and thank her every day.
That's going to be episode 22. You can let her know. Lissa, go ahead and tell us what's going on in the teacher's lounge.
Well, some fresh food is what's going on in California. There's two schools that are completely hijacking their lunch program, and they are serving 100% organic and GMO-free meals to their students. It kind of started a couple years ago. They did like a pilot program. It's in Sausalito, California, and Marin City.
Yeah, so that's like right near San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah, some high-class areas.
There are some nonprofit organizations helping make this happen in that area, Conscious Kitchen and the nonprofit Turning Green. Basically, it's really like an educational curriculum also. It's not just that they're providing these healthy meals. They're actually teaching the students. They say that comes along with it. It's farm to table, so you have to know which crops are in season and how to prepare those to make a meal with what, you know, what the earth is providing at that time.
I know farm to table movement really, I want to say it started around that area. And I wish I could remember the chef. I'm furiously Googling as I'm talking, but that all began there. So it's kind of neat to see it go into an actual school.
Yeah. And, you know, GMOs is a big topic. You know, there's that, what is that documentary? What the Health? Have you seen that documentary?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's funny because I pulled it up last night. I've pulled the documentary up multiple times, and like I finished doing laundry and everything, and I go to sit down to watch it, and it's like I can't do it because I'm scared that it's going to really change my life and that I'm going to all of a sudden not, you know, eat certain things, you know, and that I don't have time to make those changes right now. But there is a lot of research out there about GMOs in food, and, you know, 80% of the food in a supermarket is GMO. And then, of course, a lot of the heat and serve food that is stereotypical of a lunch room is, you know, just ridden with it. But they did do a pilot program, And they said that attendance was up and achievement was up, and they feel like this, you know,
crediting the food.
They feel like it had something to do with it.
What do you think?
Are you asking me?
Well, let's start with Tyler. What do you think, Tyler? Do you really think that? I mean, I don't want to poo-poo this, but but I mean, really, attendance is up because of the food you eat? I don't know. I think that's.
There might be something to that, but you know, if you have good school lunch, then kids are going to eat that and they're going to want to come to school. So it's like any other, you know, like a good restaurant, if you have good food, people are going to come. But to say that test scores are up because they're eating non-GMO food, no, I'm not going to buy that one.
I think this is great, but it just sounds expensive, and I know they're getting help. I mean, I would love to see this all over the country. And it was Alice Walt Waters, who was the chef out of San Francisco, that I couldn't remember. But you know, I just want to see this be a design that could be implemented elsewhere. And I don't know if that's the thing.
Mm. Well, and it could be that when they say achievement is up, it could mean because. Maybe children aren't as ill as often, and so therefore they are attending.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they're not eating things that maybe upset their stomach or make them feel like they, you know, have gone days without being able to relieve themselves, because sometimes that can cause a lot of discomfort in children.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what I thought, I have a picky eater. One of my children was extremely picky as a youngster, so this would be like his worst nightmare, probably. You know, like, what? Vegetables? Like, no! Yeah. You know, so I bet that there were some growing pains, I'm sure, you know, but I think part of their program is, you know, we're not just slapping down a sweet potato on their plate, like, we're actually making it part of a meal to where it has the flavors and the spices that it needs to accompany the meal to make it really good. And then you get excited about those different crops that are in season, you know.
My biggest fear, though, would be the scalability. When you have like a small school district, you know, or a small school, yeah, you could probably spend some more time doing this. But if you get like a big school, a high school with 2,000 or 3,000 students, that has to run through 5 different lunch programs during the day. Is there enough time?
No. So, yeah. This is a school of 500, just to tell you how many they're feeding. But I know a lot of my friends would want this program, but I do see where, so maybe they pack their child's lunch every day and maybe they would not pack it. Maybe they would let them eat in the school cafeteria. So those numbers would probably spike a bunch. I don't know. I think I do think we're going to have to, you know, I guess I feel like the way we have found out about cigarettes and things like that that are, you know, years later deemed harmful.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that
GMOs might be the same.
I think that in the future, I do worry that, you know, that we are doing things. I mean, the whole point behind a GMO is that it, you know, you're taking a trait from one plant that's a good trait, and you're genetically manufacturing it into this new plant. So maybe it can withstand drought. And so, you know, well, what's harmful about that? You know, but we don't know. That's kind of the big topic right now is what if one day we find out that, you know, we've been feeding our youngsters things that did cause more illnesses in the future or, you know, I don't know. I think it's something that we're going to see more of, I betcha.
Tyler, I know, you know, any listener of the show knows how often we talk about transitioning schools into the digital age. And we're always like, you know, are we going to need textbooks, actual paper textbooks forever? Or is all that going to be on an iPad? But a study came down just within the past week or so that really has shed some light on the whole digital paper divide, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this was published in Business Insider, which, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think is the go-to place for educational literature. But regardless, there's a study that says students learn more effectively from print textbooks than they do from screens. And it's the research is there, and it is comprehensive. They've got a review of research from 1992 from in the article. And so when I saw that, my first thought was, it was 1992. So, of course, yeah, back then, everybody was, you know, paper was better. But I looked through their research, and, I mean, they've got close to 100 articles that they've quoted from. Most recent was published in 2017. So, you know, this is not just some, you know, this isn't old folks saying computers are bad and books are good. But it seems to be true that, yeah, if you read a print copy of a text, you'll have better insight to the complex ideas that are in the text. So the study is actually pretty interesting because when they talk about it, they say that students, they prefer to read digitally. They read faster digitally than they do in print. And they believe that when they read digitally, they believe they understand it better. But paradoxically, they don't. So that kind of hurts the kids. The interesting thing that, to it, though, is that if you ask a student a general question about, like, general understanding, what's the main idea, who's the main character, those kinds of questions, it doesn't matter what they're reading. If they're reading print or if they're reading digitally, they're going to get the same answer and they're going to be right. But when we talk about more complex ideas, it seems that reading in print is better than reading on a Kindle or an iPad or a computer screen.
But how do they know that? How do they? Are they just thinking that if they're reading digitally, they're skim reading, and so therefore they're not really diving deep into the literature? Is that what they're thinking?
It's, yeah. So what the research is showing is that as when kids are, or anybody, I guess, not just kids, but when people are reading online or reading digitally, they go faster. And print, for whatever reason, maybe because you have to turn a page, it slows you down. And so what they've found, though, is that people who are not used to digital text, if you give them digital text, they're, you know, not used to it, so they slow down. And that group who slows down when reading digitally, they understand the text with a deeper understanding than those that just speed through it. So I think what really matters here is the speed in which you are reading.
Well, as a teacher, one of my favorite things about digital books is that if you see a word that you're not familiar with, you can touch on it, you know, and it'll tell you the definition and use it in another context. And I love that. I think, you know, I really think if I taught language, I would want everyone to have a digital book because I think we are all L-A-Z-Y and we're not going to go look up that word, myself included. You know, I'm just going to feel like I kind of know what that word means. Mm-hmm. And another thing is how to say the word. I find, you know, that even now, I all the time have to know, okay, wait, how does that, but how is it pronounced? You know, in case I wanted to use it going forward in my vocabulary, how do I say it?
Do you remember what they used to tell us when we were little and we didn't have iPads and stuff? Like if you came across a word, like I was told to look it up or like have a sticky note and like write it out
and then
like,
go back.
And I don't think I've ever done that.
I did, but it's very time consuming. And then you're kind of already out of the context, you know? Yeah. If you really want to know what that is, you just click on it. Also, I love that you can look, you know, for a student that they can quickly find reference in the text because so much of standardized testing now is can you find something in the body of text to back up your answer?
I think the real tipping point is going to be when you grab your iPad to read your child a story on an iPad. And I don't know that that's going to ever, it may eventually happen. I don't know.
I think picture books are here to stay. Yeah. I mean, obviously. Yeah. I feel my heart racing a little bit because I am an artist.
I mean, you can still have art on an iPad, though.
I know, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
And so I do think picture books are still here to stay. And I do think that digital books are excellent for youngsters, and it definitely grabs their attention. But I do think when you have a child third grade and below, especially in the pre-K years, as a parent, you need to be reading picture books with them too because so much of their understanding, they draw from the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so they're hearing what you're saying, and that's wonderful. And it's you that's reading to them, which is excellent, but they're drawing a lot of understanding from the images.
There's a lot of really good things about digital text. And one of the things the article says is that you've got to consider the purpose. So, you know, when you're thinking about a three-year-old, a four-year-old, yeah, of course, picture books, that makes perfect sense. And like you said, for a high school student, sure, maybe a Kindle version makes sense. But, you know, I am the I'm an English teacher, and so, you know, one of my favorite books to teach was, has always been, A Farewell to Arms. And so I have taught that book, I don't know, at least once a year for the last 10 years or so. More than 1,000 kids, over 1,000 kids, I'm sure. But the book that I teach it from is the same dog-eared copy that I have 300 post-it notes in. I've got quiz questions written in the margins. I've got things underlined. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that you can't necessarily do with a digital version, except that you can, except it's different. But there's benefits to both, I think. And so I think, you know, I would not be surprised if we live in a world in the future where we aren't one or the other, but we're one and the other.
I've got a feel-good story for you guys.
Okay.
Talk about putting your money where your mouth is. There's a defensive end with the Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles, who it says he's going to donate his entire salary to charity, and it's all education.
Yeah.
And he's not one of these players. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's going to make $1 million this season, but you know, he's not making a ton of money. Like, that's his base salary. And he says he's going to donate $1 million compared to some other players who are making, you know, 30, 60 million. But I can't imagine, it's one thing to donate, you know, a big chunk of change, but it's another to say, like, you know what, I don't need a salary this year. And he's already donated, looks like his first six checks would go to scholarships at private schools in his hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. And then he's going to donate the rest of the money to school charities in cities that he's played in. So Philadelphia, St. Louis, and Boston. I should note, though, you might recognize his name. His name's Chris Long, who is the son of
Howie Long.
There you go. Look at you.
I love football.
Wow. I was expecting Tyler to chime in.
I knew who he was when you started.
Yeah. So, but no, it's really neat. And, you know, he says, quote, to the Associated Press, "I think we can all agree that equity and education can help affect change and that we all want to see this happen in our country." So, pretty cool stuff, right?
Hey, that's what really if cool. This started with Chance the Rapper saying, hey, all you big people out there, these celebrities, the world's watching you. What are you going to do about it? You know, like maybe more and more people will start to step up and give back to the younger generations when education is concerned.
Yeah. I also saw Bill Gates is donating another big chunk of change to education. But, and we've had this discussion on the show in the past. I had a teacher friend who posted the story back in Virginia, and she wasn't thrilled. She was kind of like, oh, wait, great. Here's another big chunk of change. Like, she was kind of a cynic about it.
Well, I think sometimes, which, I mean, you know, I hate to even put that out there because you don't want to make it seem like teachers are not. Yeah, you don't want to make it seem like teachers are not grateful. But I think sometimes as a teacher in the classroom, maybe those funds never really reach your doorstep. You know, it gets boggled up in something else that is, you know, maybe something that's never even going to come to full circle. I do think it's cool when private people donate money like I hate to say Chance the Rapper again, sorry, but he said, you know, nope, you know, I'm not going to have this get boggled up into this and this. Like, I'm going to meet with each principal and we're going to come up with something that definitely works for their school. But then he also hired advisors to help manage the way the money was being spent and to make sure it was being spent effectively. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we've talked about that before, how sometimes it seems like a lot of money, but it's just a drop of, you know, especially when it has to be spread equally over an entire school district and everybody gets a little bit of it. You know, sometimes like what Long is doing is he's pinpointing specific schools. So it's not necessarily the whole district, you know, so you will see that money at That's your true. Doorstep, you know.
Yeah. And when you think about like Bill Gates and he's going to donate, it was a few million dollars.
It might have been over a billion. Hang on. Go ahead. Yeah.
But when you think about it, you know, if you put it into perspective, when you're thinking about a big school district that has, you know, 40, 50 schools in that district, their budget is going to be in that hundreds of millions of dollars anyway. So if you're spreading it out from 10 of those school districts, you're not really adding too much. But, you know, every little bit, of course, always helps. But I think a lot of people often don't always understand that school districts are big, big enterprises. And they need to be treated like that. They are some school districts are as big or bigger than Fortune 500 companies.
Right. It's frightening to even realize how much money it takes to change a school district. To answer your question, Bill Gates is investing $1.7 billion over the next 5 years. That was announced 3 days ago.
Well, that's not a small sum of money. So that's going to do some. That's going to do something, I'm sure. But you know, I there were some computers that I worked with not too long ago in a school district that were bought by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So you know, I do see some of this stuff end up in classrooms.
I really think a lot of it has got to go to the teachers. We already don't pay teachers enough. So let's pay to send them to a training or have someone come in and show them this new way of formatting their lessons, you know, to make math more exciting or whatever.
Yep.
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I got to tell you, the coolest professional development that I ever was a part of was funded by a grant, and it was a scholarship sort of opportunity. And I went and I was able to ride the zero G. And so I have been weightless in my life.
Gosh, that is cool.
That was the coolest thing ever. It was just a group of teachers.
Wait, was that like the airplane where you actually float? Like where you dive down? You've done that?
Yes, I have.
Well, that's like a whole episode.
I know. That might be a whole other episode. But it is the coolest, by far, professional development that I've ever been a part of. And I came back from that as energized as I've ever been to get back to the classroom. And, you know, I was an English teacher, and this was more of a science thing. But still, it was worth it. It was cool. And
Do we have video of this?
I do have some video somewhere. Yeah, in fact, it's right here. I have a DVD. It's over here in my office.
Oh, he's like, wow. Oh, it's right here. Hey, it was on The Bachelor. Do you know he took a date on The Bachelor?
It's on The Bachelor.
She vomited.
Yeah. Did she? We'll see. Yeah. All right, so I just got to ask you, Tyler, because I don't know a whole lot of people who have done this. So you go up, what, 50,000 feet? And then you dive to like 30,000? Like, what do they do?
So I don't know the exact,
you're just way up there though, right?
You're just way up there. But we went out over we went down to New Orleans and we took off from New Orleans and we flew out over the Gulf to an area that is, it was like zoned for military aircraft only. So it's,
yeah. And you're over water just in case if you crash.
Yeah. Right? So, exactly. But we're out there and they go up high. I'd want to say it was about 70,000 feet actually.
Wow.
And they dive. And when they put this thing into a dive, it's not like a gentle, like,
no.
Okay, we're going to descend. It's nose down, straight down to the, earth. There's only four windows in the entire aircraft, and those are in the emergency exit
areas. So you can't really see outside.
No. Yeah. So you don't know that you're diving. You just know that suddenly you are floating.
Wait, wow. Feel it in your tummy? You don't feel it like,
Feel it. Yeah. Oh, you feel it. Okay. What happens is when you dive, you're not weightless. It's you're actually experiencing G's when you dive. And when you hit the bottom of the parabola, you experience multiple G's. I forget how many. But as you come up, think of like throwing a baseball in the air. When you come up to the top of the arc, if your hand comes up and is holding a ball in your hand and stops... Well, the ball is going to keep going because, you know, Newton's third law, right? So the ball is going to keep on going. And then as the ball starts to drop your hand, if it also drops, then the ball experiences weightlessness longer. So as you go up, then the ball goes up and then you are the ball. And then as the airplane begins to dive, you experience that moment of weightlessness for about 30 to 40 seconds each time.
Wow.
And then... So
you're strapped in, and when you start diving, you unbuckle?
No, you're
not strapped in.
The floor is like a big gymnastics floor mat thing. It's just padded floors, padded walls, padded ceilings. And when you're in a zone, there's three sections of the aircraft, and you're in a zone, and I was in the middle zone. And then as you go down, you are supposed to lie down on the floor to kind of better handle the G-force. And then as you come up... you just know it, like, oh, okay, now we're weightless, and you just start, you push off the walls, and you throw each other around, and you drink water as little droplets, and you try and throw M&Ms at each other. It was the coolest thing ever.
Wow. At any point were you like, this was a dumb idea, like, right before
I'm going to die.
Yeah.
No, it was one of the coolest things I've ever done. That, we did have one of my classmates who was there, another teacher, she did look out the window, which did cause her to throw up.
Yeah, so, I can't imagine.
Because if you look out the window, you know, then you notice, hey, I'm not horizontal anymore to the horizon. The horizon is now at a 70-degree down angle, and then suddenly now the horizon is at a 70-degree up angle. oh my gosh. And then she,
I mean, I want to talk to the pilots because they're basically taking a passenger jet and making it like it's a fighter jet.
So, but what's cool is you watch like the seatbelts, because there's seats right in the back of the airplane, and you have to like be buckled for takeoff and landing. You know, those are all, it follows the same FAA regulations and everything. But you see the seatbelts just like go up, like up in the air, and then they just drop.
So wow.
That's a cool thing to see too.
Well, and do you subtly fall back down when you, when you're coming out of?
Relatively subtle, but I mean, if you're like hanging out at the top of the on the ceiling, then, and then you just, you go back down. It's not, it's not painful or dangerous.
It's so padded.
Yeah, it, but it's not like you're gonna fall out and like suddenly boom. It's more like, oh, I'm going down now.
All right. Well, are you guys ready for the Brad idea?
Yeah.
Definitely.
We are going to be talking to an expert in the world of open textbooks.
Oh, good. That works for the digital learning, too.
Right. Our guest in today's Brad Idea segment is the director of Open Education with Creative Commons. Dr. Cable Green has over 20 years of experience in academic technology and online learning, and holds a PhD in educational psychology, and he's the leading advocate for open licensing policies. Dr. Cable Green, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
A few episodes back in our show, we briefly touched on the idea of open textbooks. And so I scoured the internet and I wanted to find one of the leading experts in open textbooks, and that is you. You are the guy who apparently is helping spread the word and kind of ease open textbooks all around the world and in college education as well as K through 12. Why has this been so important to you?
Open textbooks are kind of part of a larger movement called open educational resources, and that's part of a larger movement called open education. So let's start from the top. We'll work our way down to open textbooks. Open education is the idea that that everybody in the world should have access to high-quality educational resources and learning opportunities. And so there's a global movement, has been for about 15 years, to do what teachers already do, and that is to share knowledge. And what we're able to do with open education is to share more completely and with more people for less money all around the world. And the main reason for that is really because of three things. One is the educational resources we use and have used for the last decade are born digital. Of course, we still use print, but digital is interesting because when things are digital, you can store, distribute, and copy them for near zero cost. The second thing that happened was the internet, so we can move all this digital stuff around the world at near speeds of light. And the third thing that happened was open licensing, which I'm sure we'll chat about later. So because of those three things, all of a sudden, educators, teachers, professors around the world started to ask questions like, well, how do I share my content? It's copyrighted, it's digital, but is there a way to easily share it around the world? So when something is, when a piece of content, education content, is both freely available and it has the legal rights on it that lets people not only use it for free, but make copies, modify it, change it, share it with others, we call that an open license. When it's got both those things, free and the legal rights to modify, we call that an open educational resource. Open textbooks are one of many types of open educational resources.
I watched you give a presentation a few years back, and specifically to open textbooks in the K through 12 environment. You got a little fired up at one point because you were talking about your home state that you're currently in right now over Washington, and the amount of money that the state was spending on textbooks.
My state is tiny, big landmass, but tiny amount of people. We only have 1 million public school kids. And yet we spend $130 million a year on textbooks. So you would think for $130 million for a million kids, I get some pretty good stuff, right? Fact is, I don't. Here's what we get. And I've got two kids in public school, and so this pisses me off. I get a little angry when I go to PTA meetings about this. Right, so our books are 7 to 10 years out of date. Is it okay that you're giving young minds educational resources that are 7 to 10 years out of date? I mean, political science. When we were at the public hearing, one of the legislators said, here's my daughter's political science textbook. The copyright date on it was 1998. Has anything happened in politics or, you know, geopolitical anything since 1998? A few things.
You're right. I do get a little fired up on these topics because I mostly I get irritated, is a nice way to put it, when I see public money being spent poorly. There are, to give you a sense of how much money we spend as a nation, the United States, just in K-12, spends somewhere between $6 and $9 billion, so that's billion with a B, a year on textbooks and other curriculum. The number in my state, I live in Washington State, we spend right around $130 million a year. And so you think, well, that's quite a bit of money. But for that money, we get pretty terrible results. So on average, our books are 7 to 10 years out of date. They're paper only. We don't have any digital versions for the most part of our resources. The students can't write or highlight in the books. So all the study skills that we want students to be able to use, they're not allowed to. And because, of course, we have to keep the books for 10 years, so we have to keep them as nice as possible. The students can't keep the books at the end of the year. So, you know, congratulations on finishing sixth grade math. We're not going to take all your math resources away from you. And right. Good luck in seventh grade. We hope you memorized it. The books are all rights reserved copyright. So even if the teachers have something innovative or creative that they'd like to add to the book, or maybe the book's out of date and needs to be updated, we don't have the legal rights to do that. And the thing that gets me particularly irritated is that most school districts around the United States, if the student loses the book, the parents are on the hook to purchase a new one. And that can be well over $100 per book to replace those. And oftentimes students aren't allowed to graduate until they replace those books or, you know, get other benefits at school. And of course, if you are a family that doesn't have very much money, so for example, in my state, we have a lot of migrant families that come through that are picking apples and, you know, other fruit we have in Washington State. And I've been in orientation meetings where I've heard these parents say to their kids, you cannot take your books from home to school and back to do homework. So you need to make friends with somebody who has enough money that, you know, they can replace a book, because wow, we don't. And so we're, you know, for the privilege of spending $130 million a year, those are the kinds of results we get. And it doesn't have to be that way. We can do it with open educational resources for a lot less money and get much better results.
Now, it seems to me like a lot of your work, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, you're trying to go around the world even and try to, you know, bring these resources, these open resources to, say, Africa or even universities in the United States or universities all over the world. Have you been able to see much of a difference in K through 12?
Yes and yes. So you are correct that this is a global movement, and it's a multi-directional sharing that's going on, which is the way it should be. So certainly works that are created in the United States are being shared around the world and vice versa. As far as growth, yes, in the United States, K-12 open education resources growth has been accelerating in the past few years. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is K-12 was quite a bit behind higher education in talking about OER and open textbooks and other aspects of open education, and they're now catching up fast. The main reason for that is that the lack of awareness was just really low. People didn't know about it. Another thing that's happening is there are several and have been several really excellent K-12 OER projects out there. When I say OER, I mean open educational resources. Mm-hmm. For example, CK-12 has been a project that's been around for a long time, where and I should say all these projects I'm about to list here have Creative Commons licenses on them, which we can talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. But this means that they're freely available and you can modify them. So CK-12 is kind of like high school STEM curriculum. OER Commons has been a fabulous resource for K-12 for over a decade. It's both a repository and also a set of it's an online community and a set of professional development activities for K-12 teachers. Open Up Resources is a fairly new nonprofit that was set up really to build math and ELA curriculum aligned to Common Core state standards. And what's interesting about these guys is everything that they're building has a Creative Commons attribution license on it. And they're giving this state-of-the-art updated curriculum away to school districts. So, and then of course there was kind of the big one was a project called Engage New York, which came out of New York State. This was, they took some Race to the Top money, about $40 million and built OER for K-12. And it's been so popular. There was actually a RAND report that just came out talking about the percentage of school districts across the country that have adopted just that curriculum. And so not only are we seeing just increased OER use because of all of those types of activities, but along with that use, awareness raising comes up. And if you are a school board or a principal or a teacher or a superintendent, it's not rocket science to start to ask, you know, why aren't we doing this? And more districts are jumping in.
And I imagine saving a ton of money, right?
Yeah, saving a lot of ton of money, and then also using they're rebudgeting that money. So I used to spend, you know, $500,000 on textbooks. Now I spend maybe $100,000 because I want to print a lot of this OER for my students and then provide the digital copies for free. Maybe I'm going to take that other $400,000 and buy everybody a laptop or a tablet.
When you talk about Creative Commons license, I'm going to try to explain it and then you tell me how bad I messed it up. But it's essentially the nonprofit that you work for, and you guys have already designed or looked through it from an attorney standpoint to where you can just kind of slap this copyright on, whether it be a YouTube video or a book or whatever, and now it's open and protected to the appropriate degree. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty close. So yeah. Anytime anybody creates anything, really, a creative work. So the moment that I type some text, the moment I take a picture, the moment I shoot a digital video, all of those objects, all those works are automatically protected by copyright law. And there are copyright international treaties which allow your copyright to be protected in other countries. And there's nothing wrong with that. It protects your rights, so nobody else can copy or distribute or perform the work or modify it without your permission. And that's what stops you and me from taking, you know, a Harry Potter book and making copies and selling it in our driveway. That's a violation of copyright. So that's fine for people that don't want to share. But in education, sharing is sort of the whole point. We are in the business of sharing knowledge. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And so educators around the world for the last 15 years have said, how can I keep my copyright? How do I keep my ownership? And at the same time, give everybody in the world a license or a set of legal rights to use my work under the terms and conditions that I choose. And so Creative Commons is a global nonprofit. As you said, we build the open licenses that the world uses to share copyrighted works. And not just educational resources, but images from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So we just worked with the Met in New York City, and they released 500,000 high-res images into the public domain using our public domain dedication. There's music online that has CC licenses that you can use to remix other people's music. There are documentary films and other movies that have CC licenses. So whenever you see a Creative Commons license, and there are about 1.2-ish billion CC licenses on the web that at least Google can see right now, we think there are a lot more than that. When you see one of those, what you know is two things. One is I can use it for free, and two is I can legally use it, and I'm not violating copyright. Nobody's going to sue me. And as long as I follow the terms of the license, I'm good to go.
In one of your speeches, you started to mention a success story out of Poland.
So in the United States, the states or the school districts buy the textbooks and other curricular materials, and then the list that I went through before is what happens, right? We buy them, we keep them for 10 years, mm-hmm. we take them away from kids, et cetera, et cetera. But every kid gets a book. It might be old and out of date, et cetera, but you get one. In Poland, the standard is that the parents of the school children have to buy the books. And so if you are somebody that has plenty of money, this is not an issue. If you're a family in Poland that doesn't have a lot of money, then it's a huge problem, because the books are expensive. And so, roughly 50% of the children in Poland didn't have access to all the educational resources they needed to be successful students. And so, of course, that's not okay. And Creative Commons has a team in Poland. One of our chapters is there in Warsaw. And they worked with the president's office as part of another digital initiative in the country and put out a really small amount of money, roughly the equivalent of $11 million US. And, you know, when you're talking about a national government budget, that's a right. tiny drop even for, you know, Poland. And they were able to put that money out and build Creative Commons attribution licensed textbooks. And because they had the CC license on them, they were freely available. not just to half the kids in Poland, but to everybody. So for, you know, real small amounts of money, these are problems that can be solved.
If somebody's listening, and if let's say if they're a teacher or even maybe a school board member or a superintendent, where do you start?
Sure. So step one is really awareness raising. And if you want to see a really nice model, I'll brag a little bit and point to my home state. If your listeners go to their favorite search engine and type in Washington State K-12 OER, the first hit should be the Office of Superintendent has an OER unit. The woman that runs it, her name's Barbara Suits. I know she'd be happy to talk with any of your listeners that wanted to learn more about this. But they took this in two phases. So phase one was awareness raising. We knew that across the state of Washington, that most school boards, superintendents, curriculum directors, principals, and teachers didn't know what OER was. They've never heard of Creative Commons licensing. They didn't know that this was even a thing. And so the first step really is to raise awareness. You can't really engage in this conversation. You can't launch big projects. You can't start to talk about shifting money to fund open instead of closed content until people know what this is and what the opportunities are, why it's important, and what they can do next. So that's step one. And we took a whole year in this state just doing that, making sure that everybody had the opportunity to learn. Then the next step is to start to find leaders. So in Washington State, there were grants that were provided to school districts that wanted to start to shift some of their curriculum, or in some cases, all of their curriculum to OER. And then we provided some, or not we, the state of Washington provided some support in the form of grants for them to do that. And it's not just Washington State that's doing this. There's some fabulous K-12 efforts in New York, in Louisiana, and in many other states as well. The biggest challenge, though, I would say, is that this is a real cultural shift, right? We, in K-12, and this is true in higher education as well, when we think about educational resources today, we think about them as if they are scarce, right? We think we have existed in this culture of scarcity mm-hmm. for a long time. And that was true when things were all printed, and it was true before the internet, and it was true before open licensing. It's not true anymore. Today, we can, yes, spend a lot of money to build a great resource, yes, spend a lot of money to maintain that resource, but once it's built, we can make a million or a billion copies of it for near zero cost, and we can share it with everybody on the planet. And translating into different languages doesn't cost that much. Modifying it for local use doesn't take that much time. And so that's shifting from a culture of scarcity and thinking about resources in that way to shifting to thinking about them in terms of abundance. And so how, you know, to start to talk with districts and ask them questions like, you know, if you had, if it was possible for every one of your kids, teachers, their parents, and anybody else who wanted to have a copy of their educational resources to keep those forever, that those resources would continuously be updated, that they would be pulled from the best content from around the world, that they would be standards aligned, and that your local district would have the legal rights and the technical ability to modify them and tweak them, not to mess up the standards alignment, but to provide local examples, because maybe you live in Seattle instead of Spokane, and there's you want to talk about salmon instead of mountain goats.
Right.
That's a very exciting proposition. And then to find out that you can do all that for less money than you're spending now is what gets people excited.
Well, again, Dr. Cable Green, the director of Open Education with Creative Commons, we really appreciate you enlightening us on this, and hopefully some folks will be able to take this information and run with it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Are you ready for the pop quiz?
I certainly am.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Oof, one subject. I would say... this is a bit of a cop-out, but I would say interdisciplinary studies, because I believe that all of the world's complex problems actually require a systems-level approach and not one discipline alone.
Well, it's the first time we've had that answer, so I don't know if it's a cop-out. The next question is, what are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
This. We should be teaching sharing in school. In fact, we're about to launch our CC certificates, and one of the things I want to do with these, they're of course all OER and freely available. I want to remix these and put them in schools of education so the next generation of teachers that come out understand sharing and why it's important so that we start to share more with each other.
What does every child deserve?
Well, in the context of education, I think every child deserves access to the very best current information and knowledge that society has produced. And that means that all of the content needs to be openly licensed, and it means all of the research needs to be open access. And I'd also say that every child deserves the joining the best learning communities and having access to the best instruction with teachers that are using state-of-the-art open pedagogical practices.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
I'm going to limit my answer to public educators, if that's okay. As I travel the world, I continue to see not only the United States government, but other governments as well, pulling back from their investments in public education. And so what we're missing is resources. So we're missing real money and real time resources. And that needs to be turned around, because the single most important investment that any government can put into its citizenry is a strong public education system.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
The best gift? Let's say teaching them about open education.
What teacher changed your life?
You know, the teacher that changed my life, probably my fifth grade math teacher. She had multiplication drills on the board, and she turned learning math into a competition. And I'm a fairly type A competitive person, and I wanted to win. And she kind of tricked me into making learning fun, and I always thank her for that.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Oh, I always have a pen.
All right. Again, Dr. Green, we really appreciate your time and all your knowledge on the subject, and kudos to you and all the great work you're doing and just spreading information around the world.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. That's going to do it for episode 22 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show, and we'd also love it if you'd give us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Tyler with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.